This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Our next speech is from a man beloved by many people in many social movements. His 1998 book, The Ecology of Commerce, became a hit in business schools. He also co-wrote Natural Capitalism, Creating the Next Industrial Revolution with Amory and Hunter Lovins. And lately, Blessed Unrest, How the Largest Movement in the World Came into Being and Why No One Saw It Coming. This is his keynote address to the Gaining Ground Resilient Cities Conference in Vancouver, Canada, on October 20th, 2009. It was recorded by Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. The topic, the city and the resilient future. Enjoy.
Resilient is one of those bright, shiny words, you know. It sounds so good, excuse me. It's something you think associate more with yoga, really. Supple and flexible, but it's interesting how it's been sort of co-opted into ecosystem thinking about systems that are tough, that don't break, that bend, and then can recover and restore themselves. My speech was entitled by someone, I'm not sure who, but the City in a Resilient World, and I actually think it should be called Resilient Cities in a Brittle World, because cities have always been resilient. They are probably the most resilient thing that human beings have created is cities. Cities is where people experience the most freedom. Even under dictatorships and oppressive regimes, cities are the freest place within those regimes. And cities, of course, are just archaeological digs. Jericho is, 10,500 years old. Jerusalem's been destroyed 36 times, and it's still there. And when even New York and Chicago, places like that, when you do new buildings, you find artifacts of the past. And in, as I say, in some places in Syria, you find 20, 30 cities beneath the cities that are there, Damascus and places like that. So cities themselves are an artifact of humanity that have really bespoken of their resiliency in many ways. Holland at Santa Fe Institute did a study of New York City and pointed out that through wars and blackouts and depressions and other types of dislocating moments, New York City has never had more than 3 days of food in all of the boroughs, and yet it's never run out of food. So how does that work? There is no plan for that. There's nobody in charge of food for New York City, and yet somehow there's always been this a supply, this availability of food, and that goes back to speaking to the innate resiliency that cities create by themselves. And of course, Vancouver itself is on the side of the Great Fraser Midden. Now, that midden goes back, we think, 8,000 to 10,000 years of the Gohomish and the Musqueam and the Tsleil-Waututh. But really, their forebears and who was here and how long and what were they doing and so forth. So Vancouver is not new itself. It goes back 10 millennia. So this really speaks to this idea that in a sense that we as human beings have created this thing. The most complex things we create really are not microprocessors or computers, but cities by far. Now, cities are resilient for the same reason ecosystems or organisms are, and it's interesting because they're complex. And the larger they get, even though we're talking about limiting growth, in some ways, but at the same time, the larger cities get, the more complex they get and the more resilient they get. And as they get more complex, they actually get more efficient. So the largest cities in the world are the most green cities de facto. That is to say, that is where citizens have the lowest ecological footprint. Now, low doesn't mean desirable. It just means lower than those who live, obviously, in the suburbs or in rural areas. And who knows? You know, it may very well come to pass soon that the 30-story one-block agricultural structures will start to go up in our cities. These farms, these are vertical farms that can supply 50,000 people with food in just a one-square-block area. I don't know how it would be here with maybe a bit less because of the weather, but the point being is that I suspect that more than just rooftop and urban farms, I suspect that we will create city farming in the truest sense of the word. Now, what we do know about the Earth is it doesn't need cities at all. Earth would do very well without metropolitan areas, and cities desperately need the Earth. But what civilization desperately needs is cities, because it's really where civilization is created. And in fact, the root words of cities and civilization is the same. So in a way, they're synonymous. So our fate as human beings really depends on cities. And it's not, you couldn't put a finer point on it. It's just the fact. So how we reimagine and redesign our cities in very much the ways that Mayor Robinson was talking about is really not just about our cities, nor is it just about looking to other cities like Portland's and Malmo's and the other cities around the world that are taking these initiatives and so forth and benchmarking and iteratively trying to find out and learn more of what we can do, but it is simply and fundamentally about saving civilization. And I feel like humanity has a kind of, what we call it, a sort of a collective intelligence right now. Now, we know a year or two ago it was announced by UNCED and some other organizations that half of all humanity now lives in cities. Well, and that by 2050, 80% of all people will live in cities. And I said, well, what's happening here? Why? And the why to me is on several levels. One is a very practical level, but one's on an intuitive level. On an intuitive level, I think what's happening is that we as a collective humanity on Earth are moving towards what I would call biological arcs. And I never thought I'd be calling a city a biological arc, but it is. Because it is a place where we as human beings will have the least impact. And we will demographically peak at 8.9, 8.7, some people say 8, but between 8 or 9 billion people in this century. And part of that peaking is being accelerated by cities themselves, because cities are the number one, really, cause of birth control. Now, I am including with that, I mean, I should, with number one, obviously, women's education, healthcare for women and families, women's rights, you know, but cities themselves are the place where birth rates always drop to the negative, to below replacement rate. And it makes sense to have a lot of children out in the country. It really does. That is your social net. That is the redundancy. That is resiliency. But in the city, a mother and father want to pour all the resources into that one child, maybe two, in terms of their education, their development, so that their lives and their families can improve. And that cannot happen if they have many children in the city. It's more expensive. And the second thing is that we have the sense of, especially when we think of the developing world, of cities as great, great concentrations of poverty. Well, yes, they do concentrate poverty, but nobody goes to a city to become poor. People go to a city to get out of poverty, and they are doing that. And it's maybe difficult to take a snapshot at these, you know, a favela or, you know, highly concentrated areas in Nairobi and other cities where the density and the smells and the type of housing and so forth is just almost cruel. But yet people do know on some level that in there they are going to be able to change their lives, and they are. You know, 1/6 of India's GDP comes from Mumbai. And if you've been to Mumbai, you say, well, where? It's coming from all those people in there, including the poor. So cities are performing a function that is quite extraordinary in terms of the future of the Earth. And as I said, we're going to peak at 8 or 9 billion, but then we really have to think about this in terms of long-term planning, which is then we don't just level out at 8 or 9 billion. Population begins to go down. And by the middle of the next century, there's 2 billion people here on Earth. Yeah. Because of what we're talking about, because of what we're doing, because of raising the quality of life within dense communities and cities and so forth, and changing the very needs that people have and their ability to survive based on a very different set of parameters, we will see birth rates continue to be beneath replacement rate. And we're seeing that all over Europe. We're seeing it in Japan. We have a demographic almost catastrophe coming to us, actually, at the same time that we have almost too many people. So both are happening at the same time. And the demographic catastrophe is we'll have so many older people and so few younger people to support them in their golden years, as it's called, on advertising and so forth. But so... they'll be working in those gardens.
Who needs healthy soil when you got a little cheap oil? What you don't know can hurt you.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. We are listening to Paul Hawken, author of Blessed Unrest, speaking to the Gaining Ground Resilient Cities Conference in Vancouver, Canada, in October 2009.
So we face, extraordinary challenges, though, to do this, and we face a challenge of literacy, and we really face external challenges. Now, and literacy, I want to show you this. But it says, refresh yourself and restore our world. I stole this from a Westin hotel. I call this eco-pornography. And what it shows is two shower heads, which they had at this hotel at the Annapolis Westin in Maryland. And it says, restore our world. One of your heavenly shower heads has been turned off in an effort to minimize water usage and protect one of our most precious natural resources. And I thought, this is so clever. And says, to experience the most of your heavenly shower, you can turn the second shower head on by pushing the small button behind the lower bead. And that's what this is. This is a smaller button. You push it, and you have two shower heads. Like, wow, hallelujah. And when I see that, I do steal these signs because, as I say, I have a stack of them. Because it really is about the illiteracy that is still there. And I won't say that this is disingenuous or sincere. I don't know who wrote this. And all I'll say is that it is emblematic of the perceptions that people have about the environment, which is it's out there. And just, do you want to use your towel another day? You've saved the earth, that kind of thing in your hotel, which is like so... the trivialization of the environment is still occurring in the media in so many places. And here we have a kind of level of literacy with each other, that should be at the forefront of leadership and discussion, and yet still is not. And you saw this morning, and Rob referred to it, I think Jean referred to it as well, but the headline, Copenhagen not expected now to produce a comprehensive climate change treaty. In other words, too bad. And I think that, what else did we expect? And I never expected it, and I'm not disappointed at all, because I feel that the level of sovereignty in which human beings can be effective is exactly the one that we're addressing in this conference, which is cities. And it's not because I'm addressing it. It's because at this level of sovereignty, so forth, our ideological differences are far less important or driving than what we have in common. And what we have in common drives the conversation, can drive the agenda, can drive the initiatives that are required. And it's very, very difficult to do that on a national level. It's extraordinarily difficult to do that at an international level. You saw, for example, the Saudi Arabians demanding that if there was significant cuts in oil use in the world, that they should be compensated for that for lost revenue, which is sort of like having a typewriter company ask Intel for, compensation for the lack of typewriters being sold. In other words, this extraordinary sense of the free market is good, except when we lose money. And yet these kind of demands are actually there on the table with the negotiators, and it just gives you a measure of how dysfunctional it is inherently when the conversations that occur on such a high level of perfidy and venality that you cannot really step out of that into a kind of a level of initiative that actually makes sense on a community level. Now, let me preface the challenging part of this conversation with the idea that no one knows what will happen in the future. But what I want to suggest to you is that just as climate is a nonlinear, complex, adaptive system, which cannot be really predicted in terms of what will happen and when, the fact is that everything else is too, including us. In other words, we don't know ourselves what we will do, how things will matriculate and change. But I do want to suggest that the energy picture is different than what has, I think, commonly proposed, because we actually think of energy as going up in price, We think of climate policy and cap and trade and things coming in on that level. We think of the exigencies and the pressures that climate change science will exert both on policy and people's perceptions. And we kind of look at that within a framework of business as usual. And within that, we need to make adaptive and progressive changes in all the ways in which energy is manifest in the world. And that includes water and transport and the built environment and not just energy direct use, but all the indirect uses as well. But I had the opportunity this summer to go to Greenland and with the literally with the Prince of Denmark, which I, you know, which I've always wanted to meet since I read Hamlet, and really nice guy, really nice, completely benevolent. And but we went there with also the Prince of Norway, Prince Haakon, H-A-A-K-O-N, not my name, and then Princess Victoria from Sweden. But it was an Arctic fact-finding trip about climate change. And Greenland is nominally still controlled by Denmark, although they're getting the sovereignty. And we went to the Nîmes Ice Research Station in the North Greenland, which is 500 miles from the nearest human artifact. In other words, there is nothing there. I mean, truly nothing there except the station itself, a Quonset hut, two of those, a geodesic dome, three tents, and a generator, and then an ice cave that goes down seven stories in which all the science and the laboratory work is done. And it's truly out of a kind of a Hollywood B movie, this thing you could, because you think you're going to go down in this hole in the ice and something's going to come back out that's not human, because there's this hole that goes way, way, way down, and you look down it and you get a little vertigo. And when these ice cores come up, they come up because all steaming with this sort of milky coconut milk, which they use as a lubricant, that somehow does not seem to interfere with the data from the ice cores as petrochemicals would. And so you get this kind of almost organic thing coming out of the ice, you know, and these big long things, and they're turned, you know, horizontal, and they're laid down, and they're treated so gently, you know, these ice cores. But really there in the Antarctica is really evidentiary science. That is to say, people dealing with evidence. And most of the climate science is observatory. In other words, it's observational. People are looking at changes, what are going on, and measuring those changes. Because they measure basically what happened in the past. And it was just a stunner, and you kind of wish everybody in the world could just be there, listen to the scientists, and see the level of degree and of dedication and knowledge and that is really being practiced at these sites. And there's 25 languages, 25 countries. You can only be there for a few months of the year. It was minus 22 when we were there in July. A few weeks before, one person who'd been there for 10 years walked out a little underdressed and disappeared for a day and is now a quadruple amputee. I mean, it's that quick. The environment is so severe in terms of human behavior and the ability to survive. And yet, we now know, too, that the Joides discovery, which is a ship now, we're drilling into ocean silts. And now we can go beyond 800,000 years. We can go down to 20 million years. And we're down to the Miocene, which is 20 million years ago. And interesting about the Miocene period is that the carbon levels were 400 ppm. And there's a really interesting conversation about whether it should be 450 or 350. And there it was, 400. And it was about 400 for 6 million years, quite a long time. In large part due to the volcanic action here in the Columbia Basin and up through Canada. So those data show that basically the sea level was 80 to 130 feet higher than it is today at 400 parts per million. Now, so when we have this discussion about, 350, 400, 450, and so forth, it's interesting that the data still is, in a sense, catching up with our idea or approximation of what constitutes a livable, viable future for humanity, and certainly one for the cities, most of which are around the sea or around sea level, at least most of the major ones. And I think it's important when we look at energy, we look at of cities, because we think of energy as BTUs, as joules, as natural gas, as fossil fuels, or so forth, or renewable energy, certainly, in terms of watts. But I think there's a real distinction we have to make between what we call long energy, fast energy, and slow energy. And there's three types of energy that we employ in the cities in order to make life livable. And that long energy, of course, is fossil fuels and coal and gas. But the slow energy is really glaciers and watersheds and topsoil formation. It takes time for that carbon sequestration, the humus to be built up in the topsoils, for the forest to grow and, in a sense, hold that water. And then we have fast energy, which is really rainfall and sunshine and crops. And what's going on in the world today is that we are losing all three of them at the same time. In other words, and we're drawing more and more long energy, that is fossil fuel energies, to subsidize our losses in fast and slow energy. In other words, as our soils become depleted, we add more fossil fuels in one form or another. As we lose water, not so much necessarily here up in the Northwest, but in most of the world, as water supplies are less and so forth, the boreholes get deeper, the wells get deeper, dams like Three Gorges go up. There's not many places left in the world to dam. So we use basically long energy in order to buttress our supply of slow and fast energy, in other words, to prop ourselves up. And in a sense, from an ecological economics point of view, of course, this is just a Band-Aid. It is not a fix at all. And I want to suggest to you that the oil question, and because Canada is such a strange position in the world, you know, it has 1.7 trillion, you know, putative barrels of oil in Athabasca, maybe 10 or 20% of which are recoverable, but recoverable at huge, huge, huge ecological costs, as you well know. But the oil that is there is even less than people would have you believe in many respects. One is that it takes two barrels of oil to get 3 barrels of oil in Athabasca. In other words, it's a 1.5-to-1 return. The energy return is quite low. And in 1930, when we were mining or extracting oil, it was 100-to-1. By 1970, it was about 50-to-1. 1990, it was about 15 to 18 to 1. And right now, worldwide, it is between 3 and 5 to 1. And then Athabasca is 1.5 to 1. So at a certain point, it doesn't really matter how much oil is down there. It's irrelevant. It matters how much energy it takes to get it out, not even discounting the externalization costs of the pollution, the water, and so forth. And Athabasca is there simply because natural gas is cheap. And if it wasn't cheap, it couldn't be mined at all. Now, what putting Athabasca away, if we look at the world oil reserves, Canada has, for the world, 6 months' supply. In other words, if the world depended on Canadian oil, you could get it all out. It has 6 months' supply. USA has 9 months. Okay, China has 7 months. Nigeria, the big powerhouse of oil, you know, has 13 months of oil for the world. That's it. Russia, another powerhouse, 28 months of oil. That's it. Venezuela, 26 months. You know, Iraq and Iran together have enough oil. If we were using just Iraqi and Iranian oil, and we used all the reserves, it would supply all the world's needs for the Obama administration if he is the president for 8 years. That's it. Say what you will, but there isn't that much left that out there. And the idea that somehow there's going to be more, it really is belied by the fact that there's been no real great discoveries except the Tupi fields off Brazil, which contain about 14 months of oil, but which are 2 miles below the ocean, and then you have to go through a mile of salt dome with drill bits that can withstand 2,000 degrees centigrade to get to that oil, and that oil can't even be produced until it hits $100 a barrel. So what I'm saying here is we're going into a world that has two factors. It's not just the price of oil, which is going to change and really incentivize and stimulate a lot of innovation on renewable energy and will spur the retrofits, and so much of what has to be done on a municipal level is going to be greatly enhanced by the rising price of oil. I actually look forward to it. But I also think at the same time that there is a kind of another underground or background level of understanding about energy that we have to put out there to each other, and that is that we are not just running out of oil, and obviously our carbon sink of the oceans and the atmosphere, but the things that we need in order to run this complex society in minerals and metals and rare earths and all this sort of thing are also becoming more and more scarce, and it's taking more and more energy to do that. So we are coming into a situation where basically what I've called the Red Queen dilemma, where basically we're going to start to be chasing our tail if we're not careful. Because whether it's copper, whether it's zinc, whether it's nickel, whether it's the rare earths, and so like selenite or tellurium or neodymium or that we need for renewable technologies and so forth, these things were once in high-grade mines and high-grade ores, but as the world demand expands, we're going to go into lower and lower grades, which means it takes more and more energy to get a kilo of whatever it is that you wanted to get. And it takes more and more energy to get the acre foot of water that you need for agriculture. It takes more and more energy, in other words, to do the same thing just at a time when we know, because of peak production and energy return and energy invested, that in fact oil will definitely become more and more expensive, as will natural gas. And therefore, the demand will go up at the same time prices going up, which will accelerate the rise in price. So what I'm trying to suggest here to you is that we look at energy prices as kind of a stochastic up and down thing, depending on war and demand and discovery, and that's true. But we've never faced a situation where the demands from the world as a total, the growing emerging BRIC economies, is going to have so much effect on demand that, in a sense, just as the oil, which suffuses everything we do, is at least peaking in production, if not declining, is going to be unable to fulfill or satisfy the needs that we have in order to produce more. So we are definitely in an economy where we have to go back. I'm so glad that Kansas is a sponsor. The natural capitalism, by the way, was inspired by Herman Daly, who Eleanor Ostrom, the first woman ever to win a Nobel Prize, fantastic. It's about time they could do that for the next 40 years, and we'd be about even, you know, in terms of sensibility. But and I hope that means maybe Herman can win a Nobel Prize now, finally. But natural capitalism was inspired by Herman Daly, and I was sitting at my house. I had to give a speech at the California Academy of Science. I had been talking about ecology commerce for 2 years. I was bored with hearing myself talk about it. And I was reading Daily, and just a light went on about basically we are using more of what we have less of in order to use less of what we have more of. It's really that simple. And using more of what we have less of, which is our resources and our environmental sinks and so forth, in order to use less of what we have more of, which is human beings. So our whole emphasis is on making people more and more productive, and to make them more productive, we're using more and more resources. So we're depleting and degrading our environment in order to deplete and degrade our people? Yes, absolutely, because as you make people more and more productive, you make people more and more redundant. And so what we've said, and you see it here in Vancouver, you see it around the world, we're saying to 18-year-old men and women, girls and boys, that we've created an economy that's so clever, so brilliantly designed, that we don't need you. Because there's 1.1 billion people in the world without jobs. And as a third grader, when I was mentioning this, said to me, raised her hand and said, is all the work done? Wow. And never have we had a time when we needed to do more work, right? And we have an economy that basically says it's cheaper to destroy the earth in real time, and the rest of you have to take a number, and we'll talk to you later. And when we know that's upside down and backwards, absolutely, in any way you measure or analyze or do straight classical economics, and yet those are the price signals that are being sent to us. And those are the signals that we have to work against when we introduce policy, we introduce new initiatives, we're trying to talk about retrofits and creating green jobs and reimagining the city, and people say, oh yeah, but you know, it costs too much. What costs too much? What costs too much is to waste human beings and to destroy the planet in order to do that. That's what costs too much. And that's incalculable in its price. So the resilient city, the reimagination of the city, it's nothing to do with stuff. The stuff is what you work with, for sure, but it's really about reimagining our relationship to each other. And who am I without you? Nothing. Who are you without us? In other words, who we are is defined by each other. And the city gives us this way, this extraordinary way, to reimagine what it means to be a human being. People have said to me, you know, oh man, you know, all that stuff is kind of gloomy, what you're talking about. It is not gloomy. It's only gloomy if you have anxiety about the past or you think it should be some other way. And as a friend said, if every time you argue with reality, you lose. It's just true. This is what we did. We created this moment in time on this earth. And from my point of view, this moment of time is very much about a transcendent period in which humanity can make a profound shift. And that shift depends on process, on communication, on dialogue, how we speak to each other, how we listen. And you are here, I know. You are here because somehow, someplace, someone said something, you saw something, you experienced something, or all three or more, and your worldview shifted, and it could never be unshifted back to where it was again. And I think as Gene said, I mean, very much so. I mean, sustainability is about seeing the world as a system, seeing the world as connected. And once you see those connections, you can't unsee them. And in that connection arises compassion. Because once you understand that no matter what somebody does or says, how ignorant it may be or appear, or how unhelpful it may be in terms of our future, that they're us, that's us. And so our listening must come from that deepest place. And in that deepest place is the chalice, really, of transformation. Right? I think when I wrote Blessed Unrest, it was just an extraordinary experience to write it because I could delve into the literature of the past, particularly the literature of how did we get here. I was so curious to know, how did this room happen? In other words, if we could pull the string on the flower bags of not to your flower bags, but you know, on each of us, and pull it and trace it back to your lifetime and the lifetime before, and how did these memes and tropes and ideas and levels of understanding and consciousness arise in this room? How, I mean, I'm sorry, I couldn't imagine an organic farmer standing up as a mayor of Vancouver 20 years ago saying what Gregor Robertson just said. Can you, I mean, it's like unthinkable, right? Like, it would have been like, oh, it's a dream, you know, it's a fantasy, it won't happen, you know. And this is a resource-based economy, you know, the tree cutters will dominate forever, you know. And yet that's exactly what's happening all around the world. But where did we come from? And as I wrote the book, I kept pulling those strings and going back further and further. And I have to say, for me, the pivotal point was an odd one. I was saying, what was that point that really was the cause beyond or behind the cause that we don't really see, the event that created this movement that is far beyond a green movement? And it really was Emerson, which surprised me because he just bored the heck out of me in high school. And, you know, and Prudence, and I just felt like he was so uptight. And I realized that you shouldn't be allowed to read Emerson in high school. You know, you're too immature. You can't understand what he's saying. But what happened on December 26th in 1832, his wife had died. He was deep, deep mourning, and he left for Malta and Sicily, and he was going to go to Europe and see his friends, you know, Mills and Longfellow, and he had some really good friends. And he went up the Boot of Italy, and he came to Paris, and all his journal entries up until then still have this morose quality to them. He's in mourning. He's wearing black. He's trying to recover from loss, as we all are in some way. And he went to the Jardin des Plantes and the Cabinet of Natural History in Paris, which was this extraordinary place created by the Jussot family, the Antoine Laurent and Bernard Jussot. And these were scientists before the word was invented. But they had this extraordinary ability to see patterns. And they created the first real true scientific classification system before Wallace and Darwin. And they not only created a system, but they took in their the Cabinet of Natural History and the Jardin des Plantes. They created these displays and arrays of plants and fauna that showed their relationship, showed patterns and structure and color in a way that Emerson got it. And what he got was the web of life. What he got was evolution without having that word. What he got was that everything was connected. And in his journal that night, he's ecstatic for the first time. And he realizes that we are nature, and everything is nature, and that it is all connected, and that every act that we undertake affects all other beings, all other parts of nature. And he asks himself, what is the nature of justice? What is the nature of governance? What is the nature of religion? What is human nature? And out of that, he wrote the book. He came back, he wrote a book. It's called Nature. And if you read that now, especially, you know, you see that this is a mystic. He's apt to become a mystic for the rest of his life. And his writings are really about this transcendent way of seeing the world, wherein he never loses that sensibility that we're all connected. And when he got back, really, literally almost one of the first persons who bought that book was Henry David Thoreau. And read it again, invited him to the senior class at Harvard. Emerson gives a talk. He goes to Emerson's house, Thoreau does, that night, and says, God, what should I do? You know, I mean, there's no business school at Harvard then. It's just classics. And he doesn't have a job, and he's making pencils. And Emerson says, keep a journal. And that journal, you know, produced Walden Pond, it produced Civil Disobedience, it produced so many of the memes and ideas that have informed us on both sides, because in Thoreau we had the overthrow of Louis Agassiz and creationism to succession, the idea really of that the forest actually created itself, you know, to succession as opposed to divinity, and at the same time this idea that truth was so important that you could stand for it in such a way that in a nonviolent way, and that your life was all about standing for that truth, however unpopular it was to others. And from those two, really, ideas came so much of what we do and don't even think about today. I want to, again, thank Gene for what you've done. These meetings are extraordinarily important. As we all know, often it's not the speakers that's the most important at all. It's what happens in between the speeches, which means I should get down really soon. And it's really in the hallways, in the connections that we make. And we're kind of insectivorous that way, you know, with our antenna touching and like the bees that come back and dance and tell you where the honey is. And so we can break now and dance, and you can tell each other where the honey is. And for me, I want to thank you. And if I can ever get an honorary citizenship of Canada, I'll be here in a minute. I love this place. Thanks so much.
That was Paul Hawken from the Gaining Ground Resilient Cities Conference in Vancouver, recorded by Alex Smith for you, for Radio EcoShock. Find it online at ecoshock.org, in our program archive, and on our city's page. We are out of time. Thank you for listening.